listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the 1980s, it was still unusual for a woman to become an FBI agent, but Barbara Vandriel made the cut. In fact, she tied for the highest academic score in her training class, a 98.6%. She would go on to work much in counterintelligence. She became a specialist in the Russian language. She even worked under Robert Hansen for 2 years. And found out along the way that working for the FBI was far from the kind of career that she imagined. Now she's written a book. It's titled It Never Happened, FBI Negligence and Duplicity Revealed. And she's on the phone from Southern California. Hi, Barbara. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hi, Beth, and my pleasure being with you. Really appreciate it.
So the first line of your introduction reads, I was born to be an FBI agent. Why do you think so?
Well, interestingly, I mentioned in the introduction that a cousin of mine, after I finished writing the book, mentioned to me that when I was 7 years old, he asked me. I was riding my little Royce Union bicycle around the neighborhood, and his family pulled up. And for some reason, he said, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I'd like to be an FBI agent. Perhaps I was being influenced by the early Ephraim Zimbalist TV show. Mm-hmm. But I think also that the concept of what they call fidelity, bravery, integrity, really spoke to me, and I wanted to be in a law-related career. And that's probably the short answer why that so appealed to me.
What did you imagine the life of an FBI agent would be?
I imagined that it would be very difficult because the standard would be very high. And that's something that I always desired. I wanted a career that had heroism, super integrity, camaraderie, things like that. I wasn't so interested in the money I was going to make. I knew that I would make sufficient money to live, and I did. But I really thought that it would be very difficult, Beth. The interesting thing is, daily, it wasn't that difficult because I just didn't find it difficult. What became difficult is what I describe, the dysfunctional culture that I had to navigate through.
Can I jump to a tangent right now and ask you about Andrew McCabe and this new book that's coming out, The Threat, which I understand has zoomed right now past Michelle Obama's book to be number one on Amazon's bestseller list.
Mm-hmm. I haven't even read a review yet of it. Have you read a review? I know it's called The Threat, and he's speaking about his time in the Bureau as they were looking at the Trump administration, I believe, the transitioning.
Right.
But specifically, I have to say that it's difficult to step on toes right now. But based on the culture that I experienced, and I don't believe the culture has changed, I'm skeptical. I am skeptical of the veracity of the stories. I just am.
Say more about that. I read what you're saying as there being political strategy, political intent, but what do you mean by what you just said?
Well, I know that Mr. McCabe entered the Bureau like most people who are in upper management. Only the director can be selected from outside of the FBI. Mr. Webster was the director when I first went in the Bureau, for instance. He had never been an FBI agent. So someone who comes in as a GS-10 and then goes through that culture and decides to go into management, that person, for many years, has learned what I call, as what the Bureau calls, to play the game. And it would be very difficult to get to that point without making the deals that are inherent in the way the FBI manages itself. It just, that is the culture. So one of the interesting things that I didn't really spend a lot of time on is people who remain street agents. Those who don't go into management, they have tremendous distrust of management. That's a long-seated conflict within the Bureau. I did well with the managers. I always respected my managers. But I also was careful because there was, you know, that power structure where the boss has to succeed based on the work of the agents. And you're climbing on each other's backs to go up. And It's a complicated thing to describe. I'm sure it's in other industries. But when you have a dysfunctional culture and you have to be a part of it to succeed, what's the outcome for any person who goes up the path? I ask you, even in your industry, can people maintain their integrity and still rise up?
I think that's a struggle and a challenge for many people,
right,
in life in general.
Yes.
But one of the places that you learned some of what you're describing, interestingly, was in a Manhattan office of the Bureau on the counterintelligence squad of Robert Hansen, the master spy, as he was called in a TV movie. The ultimate traitor. There are so many phrases. And he's one of the people in the book that you name by their real name. Most of the other names have been changed. You called him Bob. How do you remember him?
Well, I'll just speak very quickly to the point. I did have the book. I was required to have my book vetted by the Bureau in order to be published. And the Bureau specifically required that all names be changed but my name and Mr. Hansen, because he's a public figure. So just to clarify that point, that's why I could use his name.
Okay.
I was introduced to Bob, as you read, through the assistant supervisor, and he warned me. Now, we didn't know any of the spying was going on. I think we would have had a different reaction. But Bob was creepy. Bob was secretive. Bob did not want to be disturbed by any of the daily routines on the squad. And you were basically told, don't go to Bob with any problems. He doesn't want to hear them. He was present in the office most of the time with the door closed. So there's a couple of things that I describe in the book, as I'm sure you recall, where there were extreme conflicts, and you just could not talk to Bob about anything. That's a very strange management style, right, Beth?
So what was your reaction when all of what he had been doing, and it is possible that he was between espionage cycles in those years in the office, because when you look at the timing of what he was doing and when, and those early 80s, there could have been a gap. But when he was exposed and then convicted, how did you look back at the history you'd had there?
Well, I'm trying to recall the name of the book, but I'm sorry right now. 1985, this author, please forgive me, maybe it'll come to me, called The Year of the Spy. That's the year that Bob came to that New York office. I arrived in late of 86, and then he left in 87. It's a two-year rotation for those type of management positions. So I was quite certain when I saw, especially when I saw the movie Breach that came out in 07 and highlighted with Chris Cooper, that end of his career and exposed the intelligence work he had been doing for the Soviets. I was absolutely certain now, looking back, that he was doing this behavior when we were working for him, under him, absolutely. And he had a good reason to run the squad like a circus. That's where I have to sort of end that, because I would be revealing things that we were doing that I can't reveal. You know, national security, I'm still obligated to maintain my oath. But definitely, there's no doubt in my mind that the way he ran the squad facilitated his behavior.
You're listening to author Barbara Van Driel. She is a former FBI agent. We're talking about her book titled It Never Happened, FBI Negligence and Duplicity Revealed. Barbara, by the way, is one of the authors who has been chosen for this year's Authors on the Move event. It benefits the Sacramento Public Library Foundation. It happens in Sacramento on March 2nd. Barbara will be here for that event. I'm emceeing, so we'll have a chance at that point to meet in person.
It's going to be great.
I do want to get to something you wrote in the introduction. Mm-hmm. I'll read from the book quickly.
Okay.
A particular psychological seduction makes one feel as if one belongs to a family. Becoming a special agent with the FBI had all the feel of just such a seduction, wielding a palpable power over every facet of one's life. The painful truth was that many members of this family could not be trusted. Why? As I came to learn, powerful bureaucracies ultimately serve themselves.
I stand by those words, and that was the sad reality. I'll jump ahead into the book where, working undercover, Beth, you're required, and it's a good policy, you're required to regularly meet with the psychologist. He's housed in Quantico in Virginia. You either go in person or do things remotely over the phone and things like that. So you have access, and they keep tabs on you. And one of the things that that doctor told me, that psychologist, was that I had this very strong desire to belong and a strong desire to be very independent, you know, just lone wolf type of person. And he said, you have to find a way to blend those two things. And that desire to be in the family was a big part of why I love being an FBI agent. There were some really lovely things about being in that family. But as we all know, if you're in a family and then you come to find out that mommy or daddy or grandpa or uncle is a predator, I use those in quotes, right? You begin to lose your faith in the family. And that's what I found, unlike in any other career I've had. You know, any other work I've had, I worked before I went in the Bureau. Many people have asked me, I've done many things in medicine. I didn't encounter this kind of behavior, not like I did in the Bureau.
We haven't gotten yet to the Me Too stories, mm-hmm. and you do have many incidents of sexual harassment detailed, one in particular, a senior agent who was a former monk who was married with kids, mm-hmm. and told you there are two mandatory rites of passage: share a beer in a paper bag and go to a matinee with your partner. Mm-hmm. And you resisted and resisted, and then finally you went to the matinee. And what mm-hmm. happened?
Well, again, I mean, we had worked together by that point for about 9 months. Again, he's a married man. And by the way, it's a little... I may come across as a prude to your listeners, but it was very well known. Your reputation precedes you and follows you. I mean, this is, again, the way the Bureau is. The phone calls are made, here she's coming, here he's coming. But people knew that I was not a person who played. I was on the straight and narrow. I was a single woman with serious mindedness. So that's just the background. So here I am, 29, he's 49. Yes, there's months and months of this. We got to go to the movie. Come on, you're getting ready to be transferred. Let's go to see. We went to see Amadeus. You might remember that.
Sure.
And, all of a sudden, and this is literally out of the blue, this man begins to put his arm around me, push me in the chair, more in this movie, in the darkened hall. This was unprecedented. There had been not a single moment of contact between us for the entire 9 months. I had even at one point gone to his home and met his wife and a couple of his children just on a Sunday afternoon. So I was in shock by this, that the person was physically pushing on me more and more and more throughout the movie. Of course, in a movie, you're not going to necessarily obviously stand up. When we left the movie, there was not a word said about this behavior. That is also, like, excuse me, are you interested in me? What is going on here? Why have you crossed the line with me? And then, of course, I don't know if we want to reveal the dramatic thing that happens just a couple of weeks later.
Well,
really bad.
It's with the same person.
Yes.
And at this point, he tries to force you.
Absolutely. I mean, physically attacks me in my own apartment. We had this was something that was allowed. I lived 2 miles from the office. I could go home for lunch. I was allowed a certain amount of personal time. You could go to the gym. This was all on the Bureau regulations. So occasionally he would drop me off and say, okay, I'm going to pick you up at 1 o'clock. We'll go to our afternoon interviews. This particular day he did. Instead of just knocking on the door and am I running out, he barged in. He literally grabbed me and then grabbed my wrists and forced me down on my bed because he had come in through the back way where the parking lot was. And I literally had to fight for my life to get him off of me. And it was like I couldn't snap him out of what had ever come over him. No forewarning whatsoever. There had never been a kiss or anything between us. Just from that movie theater pushing on me, putting his arm around me, and then this behavior.
Barbara, This is only one example in the book, and you experienced this, it seems like, in a cultural way, from office to office at different times. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you faced the decision whether to file complaints against some of your fellow agents, but you decided not to. Today, is that still the right decision for you?
Yes, I do believe it was. You know, Beth, when I'm a big girl, I'm not a sour grapes person, and I had to make an ethical decision. And one thing I knew, I had a battle before me. I could win that battle through my own personal conviction and taking the high road. Let's say I did proceed with a lawsuit. My reputation would have been destroyed. I already knew the culture of the Bureau. People would have been harmed who I believe were innocent, such as the children of these agents. And ultimately, I would have been forced out. I knew this by the culture of the Bureau. I absolutely knew that I would be forced out, not on my own terms. So I thought, you know, Barbara, it was better for me to accept it. And basically, I'll say, not to sound hokey, but to forgive these people. And then to say, well, you know, I'll make my own decision, and I won't be forced. So I could I left the Bureau with the white mark, not the black mark. And that was very important, that I go out on my own terms, not be forced out.
How rare was it that you were a woman FBI agent at that point in time?
Quite rare. For instance, in that office in Houston, I think out of 100-plus agents, there were maybe 3 women. So the Bureau was slowly bringing minorities and women into the Bureau, but it was difficult to find eligible candidates.
Have you heard from anybody who recognized themselves in this book?
No, I have not. I say thanks be to God. But no, I have not.
Hmm. Yeah. Why the title, It Never Happened?
It has many meanings. I suppose the first meaning would be, I dreamt of this career. You know, the process, you know, my college professor recommending me to do it, saw within me the qualities he believed the FBI would want, and they did. So I really wanted that career. The career I wanted, I didn't have. That culture saw to it that I didn't have it. And by the way, I don't make a big point of this, but I was very successful. I tried to have humility in writing the book, but my daily interacting with my fellow American citizens was only respectful. I never had a bad day. The badness was the culture. So in that sense, okay, so the first point, didn't have the career I wanted. But one of the things that would often be said to me by these predators is, go ahead and try to say something, it never happened. And when other people did behaviors that I was involved with, not the predatory, but this nonsensical things that you read about, the laziness and the duplicity and the negligence, people always say, you know, Barb, it never happened. Go ahead and say something. So it has many meanings. And that's why I wrote it. I said it that way.
And finally, mm-hmm. When you signed those papers and left the Bureau, left the stream, but left the struggle and the betrayal too, what were you left with?
First and foremost, Beth, I was left with my integrity. That, to this day, that was my most important thing. And that's really why I wrote the book. I want everyone to read the book, anybody who reads it, and say, this is a mirror I look into. If I want to be successful in life, I must not sell out. I don't care what your job is, what your aspirations are. So I will say that it took me a while. I spent a lot of time traveling. I didn't work for many years. I had money in the bank, so I didn't have to work. I didn't want to go back into another pressurized situation. But I left, I did not leave defeated. I left with my integrity, and that made me very happy.
Barbara, thank you so much for the conversation. It has been a pleasure to meet you over the airwaves, as they say, and I look forward to meeting you in person at the Authors on the Move event in Sacramento.
My pleasure, and likewise, Beth. I look forward to seeing you on March 2nd. It'll be a great time.
That is Barbara Van Driel. Her book is titled It Never Happened. We'll post a link for more information about the Authors on the Move event that benefits the Sacramento Library Foundation. This is Insight on CAP Radio.